Good evening. You're listening to WCBN FM Ann Arbor. In place of our regular programming today, we will be doing the Writer to Writer Speaker Series, brought to you by the Sweetland Writing Center, hosted at the Literary Bookstore. Tonight's speaker is Heather Ann Thompson. Please enjoy the presentation.
Thank you, everyone, for coming. I'm Shelley Maness. I'm with the Sweetland Center for Writing over at the University of Michigan, and I run the Writer to Writer program. Tonight, we are thrilled to welcome Heather Ann Thompson as our guest. And in case you don't know about her book, I'll tell you a little bit about it when I introduce her. But I also want to give a shout out to Literati for hosting us always wonderfully. Does that sound okay? And we are also live on WCBN right now. So thank you to WCBN for partnering as well. So we'll go ahead and get started. The way this goes is a little bit of conversation with Heather about her writing process and about her teaching of writing process. And then we will turn it over near the end for questions from the audience. So as you're listening, if you have a question, jot it down because Heather would love to respond to that. So here's the formal part. Dr. Heather Ann Thompson is a historian at the University of Michigan in the Department of Afro-American and African Studies, the Department of History, the Residential College. She's a Pulitzer Prize and Bancroft Prize winning author of Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and Its Legacy, which came out in 2016. And she has been on the run talking to people weekly since 2016. She's much in demand. Blood in the Water received 6 additional book awards and landed on the over 20. One of the things that I often start with our guests is asking about how early you realized that writing mattered to you and that it was something that you wanted to do.
Oh my. Well, I have to say my mother's in the audience, so my first editor. I have to say, I don't know whether some of you here share this with me, but writing is hard. And it feels like your identity is always on display when you try to convey something on paper. And I had parents that were very good writers, and I read really good writers growing up. So I have to say that for me, writing never came easily. It never felt comfortable. And it wasn't until I really found a passion for what I wanted to write about and also just kept at it, kept really editing and thinking about what my voice was. And that was such a long process. I always used to tell myself that it's like, look, this is like learning math. You just have to learn how to do it. And then I realized later, no, you have to care about what you're doing to really want to do it. And so it's not a story of, oh, I was always a writer. Not at all. I mean, it was something that really I worked very hard at. Mm-hmm. And even as the book went to press, I relied on my editors a lot to be that eye. And I encourage all of us to do the hardest thing, which is to hand that piece of paper to someone else, your roommate, your mother, anybody to read it. And that's hard because that's like, sort of like being naked in the public square. It's like, because you're afraid. It makes you look vulnerable, or you are vulnerable,
right?
But it's good because then you get better at it, I think.
And I'm really interested in the aspect of your writing as a public intellectual, because I think, the University of Michigan is the number one public research institution mm-hmm. in the world, right? When we think about writers at the University of Michigan, we often think about strictly academic writers, mm-hmm. but you make a point in your bio of being public intellectual.
Is any less serious, any less important. In some respects, I think it's more important because it means that we're taking this enormous amount of wisdom that we've accrued over the years in classrooms and said, look, this is why it actually is relevant. This is why it matters.
Right. And that's one of the things that you and I were talking about just a minute ago before we started, was that academic writing also doesn't have to mean stodgy, inaccessible. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, so, but I was about ready to go to prison. I wrote this piece for Rolling Stone. this stuff matters, and it's right now, and that stuff animates me probably the most. Weighing in, you know, the most recent example of that, there was a big riot in the South Carolina in a prison. And it was awful because there was, in this case, prisoners had killed other prisoners. Seven prisoners were murdered, stabbed to death. The minute that story happened, I know enough after doing this book and doing the work I do on prisons to know is up here. Like, whatever the state, sure, it did not happen that way. And I knew that much. And so I immediately New York, and I did some media on this, and I didn't know anything much at that point, but I knew enough to say, don't judge whatever that, because what the media was saying, or the state was saying, was that this all happened gang fighting over cell phones. And I thought, what? This is not ring true to me. So sure enough, that then led all these prisoners from the inside to call me on their cell phones and to send me pictures of what had really happened. And I was looking at the videos of what had actually happened. And really what it turns out is that the state of South Carolina had basically put rival gang members in the same housing unit and then removed all supervision for 7 hours and let this horror show take place. And then the guys inside are trying to help each other. I can see it on the video. They're trying to bandage you. They're calling for the police. They're saying, we called the police an hour ago. Where are they? And so I immediately then wrote a piece for the New York Times because I wanted people to know that, look, this is a terrible place and you should know what really happened. So I love that kind of writing. Like, just to, like, just try to correct the record.
Yeah.
In the moment.
And how do you balance that? Because you're researching this book, well, this the one you just told us about, the book was mm-hmm. finished, but you're researching your next book currently, mm-hmm. you're responding to things that are happening in the moment, you're teaching, you're traveling. How do you make this happen as a writer in the middle of all of that?
Well, you should ask my kids. They might be in here. I mean, certain things, I also feel like we're in a particular moment right now. Prisons, policing, this is a moment. And I feel like it's not going to hopefully be here forever, but there's no choice. You know, you weigh in now or you don't. You write now or you don't. I don't know. And I do feel that there's a way in which you have to take care of yourself. And, you know, and it does get a little much to travel so much and write so much. But it's also, it's important. Yeah. So you just do.
And do you talk about these kinds of processes and these ways of thinking about reporting history, writing history with your students? Like when you're teaching, what kinds of writing do you assign and how do you talk to them about it?
Well, I'm doing a grad class right now, and I think my students would tell you that I talk about writing a lot, and I think it really, what I talk about is the importance of accessibility and writing so that we don't just speak to each other, writing in such a way that everybody can participate in the dialogue and discourse. So that's hugely important to me. But also to be creative researchers. I mean, the thing that this book taught me more than anything was that we tend to write what's handed to us. You know, here's the prompt. Here's the archive. Here's the assignment. And sometimes you don't know what it's going to be until you just dig into it. And certainly in this case, if I would have depended on the archive, it would have been a mighty short book. Right? So.
Have you ever had a moment where you started out thinking a project was one thing and then you found out halfway through that it was actually something else?
Oh my gosh. I mean, yes. And I think even more dramatically that when you write about things like Attica, or right now I'm writing about this major clash between Black Philadelphians and the Philadelphia police that all culminates in the Philadelphia police dropping a bomb on a residential neighborhood in 1985, that's what I'm dealing with now. And in these kinds of stories, you're also just feeling like, one minute you're like, oh yeah, I'm on this side of it. And the next minute, no, I'm on this side of it. And then, But they're right. No, but they're right. You're constantly being pulled from pillar to post as to who's really telling the truth of the narrative. And that's actually the most vexing thing, to kind of stand back from it and say, everybody's truth is actually right. It's just you've got to make sure it's all legible so that then the real story of what happened can levitate. But That's hard.
Yeah.
Like one minute, I've been to prison recently in Philadelphia this summer when I'm working on the MOVE book. I went to the prison. I visited Mumia Abu-Jamal in prison, who's, as some of you may know, he was on death row and very important political prisoner, and now he's serving a life sentence, and he's connected to MOVE, and I was visiting many of the MOVE 9 in prison. And then I'd be like, you know, that's the story. And then I would talk to Jim Burke. That's hard.
It's really hard. And how do you teach your students about that? Like, what do you hope to see from them?
You know, I wish I had a better answer. I mean, I think just to really just let the sources tell you what's happening, as opposed to constantly putting your own. I mean, we have to have argumentative writing. We have to say this paper will argue. We have to put some structure on a paper. But sometimes the paper takes you in a place you didn't expect, and you have to be willing to adjust. So I always tell my students, like, I don't want you to actually write your introduction until you get to the end of your paper. Then go back and tell me what this paper is about.
Yeah.
Because nothing is worse, right, than you're like, you think you're reading, it's like, oh, you get to page 10, that's what the paper's about. No. Right. Like, I want to know up front what this paper's about, but you don't know until you get to the end of it. So
right.
Give yourself the time to get to the end of it first, which means you can't write it at 3 o'clock in the morning when it's due at 6 o'clock in the morning.
Good point. Past Shelley, note taken.
Yeah.
So what do you hope to hear from, or when you're reading a student paper, what are you in, like, oh, they're getting it? What are you looking for?
I mean, I think that a confidence to have some mastery of the sources rather than the sources master them. So, for example, when you assign a paper and you say, whether it's English or history or anything, like if it's English and you say, I want you to analyze, you know, Candide, or if it's in history, you're saying, I want you to tell me about juvenile detention in the 19th century. Either way, the students are dealing with the source. And sometimes the source just overwhelms the paper, and they need to just have some confidence in their own voice. I think this is what it means, or I think that, you know, obviously in the formal language of the discipline, but to kind of take some mastery of it, some passion, some caring about the subject, so that it's not like being led all the time by the assignment. Right. And when I see that, it's great, because it means that someone's really become confident about their own voice in something. Here's just one example of that. So this book has many, many footnotes, right? But I have to tell you, I mean, they have to be there. I mean, you know, you need to know where I got this information. I'm glad they're there. But when I was first writing the book proposal for this, I remember my agent said to me, she says, well, okay, this is a pretty good proposal, but, you know, you mentioned this guy, Big Black, and she said, but, like, tell me about him. Like, tell me something about him. Like, what does he look like? What does he sound like? And I said, I don't know. I have no idea. And what I meant by that was, I don't have a footnote for that. Nobody has told me in a secondary source, no one's described him for me. So I can't then go, note, you know, the New York Times, you know, whatever, December 20th, 1970. And she said, she looked at me confused, and she said, have you seen a picture of him? Have you heard him on tape? And I'm like, yes. She says, then have some confidence. Tell me what he sounded like. Tell me what he looked like. And we as writers, especially in the academy, and especially as students at the University of Michigan, we don't have the confidence sometimes to just, like, this is what happened. This is what it's about. This is what this novel's about. This is what happened in 1962. This is what happened in the 90s. And you have to kind of have a little bit of that bravery to step in front of it. And I love when I see that.
Yeah. Well, and that's encouraging, too, that someone is still telling you that, right? Like, that you've never just mastered being a writer.
No,
like, you're,
I'm
not,
like,
done.
I don't have a footnote for that. I don't know what he looks like. Have you seen a picture of him? How about describing him?
That's going to live with you forever.
Yeah,
now.
Forever. Like, yeah. I think about that all the time.
Yeah. Oh, that's fantastic. So before we turn it over to the audience, I know I prepped you a little for this, but I don't know if you've read the questions.
I haven't.
Oh, it's going to be fun.
Oh,
so what we do at the end of every interview before we turn it over to the audience is a cribbed and reworked version of the questionnaire at the end of Inside the Actor's Studio, because performance nerd here. But we have reworked these in order to make them about writing rather than about acting. So here we go.
Okay.
What is your favorite word?
Can I have two?
Sure.
Literal. Literally, right? My whole family makes fun of me because I always say literally. 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 And passion.
Nice. What's your least favorite word?
Moist.
I think that a lot of people say that.
Isn't that a horrible word?
Horrible or perfect, because it kind of...
I don't know, man. It's bad. It the other one, sack. That's a horrible word.
What is your least favorite overused word?
Anyway. Or anyways. Yes. Or like. like.
What overused word do you actually love and then use a lot anyway? Which I think I know one answer.
Literally.
Literally the thing you like. What thrills you as a writer?
Just the investigation of it, the digging into stories I don't know.
And what thrills you as a reader?
Mysteries, the same thing. Interestingly, I love to read mysteries for the same reason. It's like, what happened? You know, being surprised by what happened, being engaged by what happened.
What repels you as a writer?
Jargon.
And as a reader?
Jargon.
Note to all of our minor in writing students,
you know, or just using certain over, you know, jargon. And what I mean by that is just using terms to fill in for real words, for filling in for real explanations, or, you know, jargon, because that's what it does. It's always just a shorthand for more complicated concepts.
Right. Whose writing style other than your own would you like to attempt?
I mean, you know, there's beautiful writers that I don't hope to emulate. People like Erin Jahdi Roy, or, you know, there's many beautiful novelists. But I think if I were to think about the kind of writing I wish I could do that I can't do, it'd be mystery writing. I'd love to be a mystery writer, like Karen Slater, like people like that.
Yeah.
I actually wrote to her and I told her, like, I love your writing. And I was so honored because she said, I actually read your book for research for my next book that I'm writing. I'm like, what? It was a total fangirl moment because I love the craft of putting together a good mystery.
Nice. And whose writing style other than your own would you absolutely not attempt?
I don't know. I think I have to take a pass on that because I might insult somebody.
Fair enough. And then finally, well, I'm going to throw an extra one in at the end because I want to know, and I think our audience probably wants to know too. But first, what three or four writers, living or dead, would you invite to your ideal writing retreat?
Oh, my goodness. Let's see. Angela Davis. To think about how to write a powerful treatise. Erin Jahdi Roy, to think about how to write about very difficult things with passion and amazing vocabulary. Oh my goodness, I don't know. There's just so many. I don't know. I'm sorry. I can't come up with more. No. I think that's, yeah, I'm just going to leave it there.
Two is great.
Yeah.
And then finally, I'm curious about what you're reading right now.
Well, it's a mystery. I am reading Sarah Paretsky's new book, which is a mystery, but she's a, you know, V.I. Warshawski, who's a detective in Chicago. So I always just read, like, the mysteries. And actually, here's a really sad confession. I don't read. I actually listen on Audible because I read every single day in my job. And so for me, pleasure reading is listening. So I actually listen.
Same. Okay, so now we have a few minutes to turn over the microphone to some audience members. I'm going to try to get it out of here without making a bunch of noise. sort of. So who would like to start out? Good. I'm going to walk back to Alex here so that people in Radio Land can hear you.
Hello. Love the talk, by the way. I really like that part that you talked about when it comes to like the torture theme. So I was just kind of wondering, you know, when it comes to the process of writing and when you're trying to figure out what you want to kind of, you know, intentionally include or exclude in your writing, especially when you're trying to, you know, compromise or not compromise, sorry, balance between that, like not being too vague, but not being too explicit. How do you know, like, how to immerse your writer in that experience or your reader in that experience? But, you know, like, how do you do that process? I'm just so curious. How do you know when it's right?
That's a great question. And to be honest with you, I'm still struggling with it a lot. I mean, the story that I'm writing right now on Move, the history I'm writing on Move, I'm facing the exact same thing. This is a bomb that gets dropped on a house that has women and children and dogs in it, and they're trapped in the basement, and I want you to know what that is like, but I also don't want you to throw the book in the fire because you can't take it anymore. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I'm experiencing that right now. So what I think is what I try to do in this book is I want you to know that it's coming and set it up in such a way that that trepidation, you feel that anxiety, you feel that kind of train wreck coming, so that I don't have to actually knock you over the head with what actually happened. I can just give you a taste of it and you know. Not in what you don't or do include in the actual violence, it's actually the setup of that. So that you understand, for example, that, you know, the troopers had been out there for 4 days. They hadn't slept. They hadn't eaten. They were passing out weapons. Nobody was writing down the serial numbers. As they're getting ready to go in, they're taking off their identifying badges. So you know, right, before the retaking, you know this is going to be bad. And so I don't have to then walk you through everybody's trauma for you to get that. And I think that's the way. But I'm still struggling with it myself, for sure.
Other questions? Ah, Jimmy.
Hi, I'm Jimmy.
Hi.
You mentioned student essays that kind of cleave too closely to one source. I'm wondering if there's anything in particular you say to your students to encourage them or give them the confidence to go into that scary space between sources.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not even sure that the problem is within the one source. The problem is in having the confidence that you actually have something to say about the source, that you actually have a perspective on it that maybe is valid, that you want to try out, that you want to, you know, you want to put on paper and say, and even though if you can't footnote it, and even if you can't, you know, you're still trying it out, you know, you need to think about it a little bit more. For me, that stuff should be encouraged. When you're reading someone who's doing that, you shouldn't say, when you're grading them, well, you know, that's a half-baked idea. What should be in the margin is, that's really interesting, so let's push on that. So if this is true, then what about this? If, you know, to develop that stuff. Because if we don't do that, then we literally are reproducing the Academy just over and over and over again. And, you know, lo and behold, we have the same discourse on prisons and the same discourse on policing, the same discourse. It's so boring. So I think that's it, really. I mean, it doesn't matter how many sources you have. It's that you've got to feel like you can actually weigh in on them.
Anybody on this side? I feel like I was ignoring this side of the room a minute ago. Yes.
Thank you for saying the statement about making history accessible. I think right now, especially, people do not know history. Mm-hmm. And so I actually had an argument. I have a master's in history, and I got an argument with my advisor that, you know, I can't be nailed on a cross of historiography. that to make it accessible, that's what we're trying to do, or otherwise it's not, people won't know it, they won't remember it. Mm-hmm. Which leads me to my question, is that how do we know, how do you find the topic? So how do you know when that topic, because I have toying with a couple ideas, how do you know when that topic is maybe overplayed? Not enough source, but it still needs to be discussed. And like in my case, I look at indigenous history. Mm-hmm. And I mean, we're told all the time to get over it. So mm-hmm. that's why mm-hmm. it's mm-hmm. important. But I'm looking at two aspects. How do you decide when that's been done to not enough? Or, yeah, there's not enough sources to access.
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. I mean, the first thing I want to say to the first part of your statement, which is that this is about whether history is accessible. You know, for many, when I was in grad school, it was in the 80s, and I think there was a huge, the worst sin in the world to be a historian then was to commit something called presentism, which meant that you were essentially weighing in on the present. And of course, when I look back on that, that's because the 80s was a pretty conservative time, and it was a real backlash against a lot of the new left historiography, a lot of the kind of women's history and African American history. And so I actually feel that it's, again, I'm repeating myself, but you know, it isn't against the profession to make history accessible. I mean, I think it's an obligation in the sense that why in the world would we want to spend all this time studying something that if it had bearing on today and not weigh in? And I think the fear is because it somehow is then biased. You know, somehow it's biased if you are to make a statement on whatever, slavery, prisons, policing, whatever, right? And of course, you know, if you know something about something and you come to a conclusion, that's the conclusion you come to. So, like, you know, there are slavery was complicated, and we need to know its complexity, but there's no two sides to slavery, right? I mean, you know, the Holocaust, it's complicated. Yes, many people did many different complicated things, and we as historians want to understand that, and we should. But there's no two sides to the Holocaust, right? So I think that that's the part where, you know, I'm pretty firm that we should be able to make that stuff accessible and present. The question about sources, though, I would say that, you know, who knows where the sources are? That's the being the detective. That's the fun part. That's the part where you just have to keep pushing and you have to be creative and you have to think about where, you know, if the source isn't there, then who might have it and who else might have had the piece of paper and who, you know, it's amazing how creative you can be. And so I'd say you write about what's important to you, what's passionate. For me, I had to think about what am I good at? You know, what am I good at? I'm a good storyteller, so my next book is going to be a big story. But somebody else might say I'm really good at the theoretical stuff. I'd rather do a theoretical piece. Everyone, you know, find your passion and just do it. Like, who cares if there's an archive? Believe me, the stuff is there. You just gotta dig for it.
And one last question to take us home.
So I'm curious about what your thoughts were or feelings were about privilege as a white woman, mm-hmm. Writing and talking about things that typically do fall under the African-American history or discourse, and possibly the reception of it, because mm-hmm. you know, I'm thinking of Michelle Alexander also writing on prisons. Can you speak to that?
Absolutely. So that's, you know, you cannot, first of all, it doesn't matter what you write on. Your privilege, whatever that is always at work. And it works in a number of interesting ways, right? So, for example, writing on Attica, there is no question in my mind, I am upfront about it to anyone who wants to talk about it, that being a white woman allowed me access to talk to the guards and to talk to the troopers that someone else, a scholar of color in particular, might not have had. I see that as privilege, but I also see it as a super high obligation to get in there and find out what the hell happened and report back. And similarly, it worked in another way, which is that there were other spaces where I was not as welcome, and I had to kind of essentially figure out a way to be clear that my story was going to be told in such a way that everyone's story was going to be honored so that I could be let into spaces that I normally wouldn't be let into. So it kind of worked in multiple ways and in multiple directions. But it's also true that I don't pretend in this story to be someone that I'm not. I mean, I tell everybody's story from their vantage point, right? And so I'm trying to tell you the trooper's story, and I assure you I'm not a state trooper. I try to tell you the story of someone who's incarcerated, but I'm not incarcerated, right? So I try to be that person that's kind of a storyteller, not pretending that it's my story, if that makes any sense. But it's also true, for just full disclosure, that I come at this pretty personally, which is to say, you know, I am a white girl, but I grew up in the city of Detroit. I went to an almost all black high school. I grew up in a mostly black city. My family is mixed. You know, so personally, I also came to this from a different point of view than maybe another white writer would have. But that doesn't mean that I didn't have white privilege coming into it. So it's navigating all of that. And it's the same kind of self-conscious navigation that you have to do everything we've been talking about, like how you write about violence, how you navigate your privilege. But at bottom, it's if you are just trying to tell the story as it really happened, as opposed to trying to tell it the way you wanted it to happen, the way you hoped it would happen, then you're okay, because then you're letting other people tell their stories. And you're just the conduit for it in that sense. And frankly, what that means is sometimes the story gets messy, and sometimes people that you don't like very well get a voice. And other people that you like a lot disappoint you and let you down. But it is what it is. So thank you for that question.
I feel like that's a wonderful place to leave it. So we are going to end the conversation. We do have copies of Blood in the Water, and if Heather has a couple minutes, she can sign some copies if anybody wants to purchase and get signatures. But Heather, thank you again so much for coming.
This is great fun. Thanks for coming out tonight.